What I would strongly recommend is, you know, especially when you've got investor money, is cash management is one of the prime operations that a CFO needs to do.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the co-founder and CEO at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's purchasing with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Julia Leisk, a CFO based in the UK, and you should listen to this podcast if you've ever wondered about your bank and what to do when things don't go according to plan. We're going to talk about the Silicon Valley Bank debacle, and we're going to discuss some strategies for making sure that you can survive it just like Julia did, thanks to her preparation. So Julia, you're very welcome to the podcast. Maybe you could just tell the listeners a little bit about you and your background and where you come from, and then we'll talk Silicon Valley Bank.
My name's Julia. I've been a fellow of SEMA now for what, 12 years. My background is in blue chip land, but I've had my own practice for 14 years now. So I'm bringing the smarter way of thinking to the smaller startups and the sort of middle range clients where they can't afford a full-time FD. And, you know, I help them with their strategy, help the CEO who needs a sounding board. So that's who I work with.
I think everyone in finance world remembers 10th of March, 2023. When, oh my God, we didn't know what was happening. We woke up and we saw the headlines about Silicon Valley Bank. But before we get into that, maybe you could just tell us about the clients you were working with at the time, just before that all happened. How did you get in touch with them? What are they doing? How were they working with you? What were you doing for them?
It was a tech startup, two very bright entrepreneurs, one from Greece and one from Spain. They set up the business in the UK. They both had a family who'd suffered stroke. So they knew, you know, when you're a survivor from a stroke, there's a lot of rehabilitation. So what their background is, they were creating a rehabilitation system, which then reconnects the neurons quicker than conventional rehabilitation. And their financial accountant had actually worked with them from very startup position, and she didn't feel comfortable doing the more advisory, the strategy, the forecasting, which is actually where my niche is. So I need to understand the compliance work, but then I actually build on that. So I was working with her for a while, and then sort of she moved on and I created a finance team based in London. I actually started with them in lockdown, so I never met them, which was, you know, just par for the course in those 2 years. And, you know, working with them very, very successfully, we'd actually embarked in expanding to the US. We could actually see the market was there waiting for us. And we were looking for further investment. And that's where we sort of had the investment, got the 5.5 million. And then that was in the bank in the UK.
You gloss over that, like we just got 5 million investment. Sounds pretty easy. But I guess it sounds like a university type of project, was it?
No, I mean, originally with it being a startup, you know, they had the initial investment through university and other smaller investors, sort of their future fund. They had used that to expand it as far as they'd got to, but then they wanted further investment to go into the US. And that was where we went to the likes of Albion, venture capitalists, and other investors.
And what are the important things to prep to go to a professional grade VC, let's say? So what were the things they needed to see that they didn't have before they met you?
Well, it was a very comprehensive sort of due diligence exercise that was requested by the investors. They wanted to know all about the, you know, 3, 4, 5 year forecasting that was needed. They wanted to know all about the operational side of the business, who the key players were in the business, sort of what the expertise was behind it, because given that you know they're handing money over to a business, they need to know that it's been managed properly. So you've got to explain who's actually in your core team and who's going to be making the key decisions. And also the legal side of it, there's a lot of sort of legal due diligence being done. So all of the contracts, and then sort of looking at the suppliers and the customers, making sure, you know, there was nothing that would, you know, raise alarm bells that was actually already within the format of the business.
So the 5 million, was the investment staged based on the cash flow projections? Were you held to it? Because I guess creating a 5 year projection on a brand new startup is kind of a bit of a finger in the air. It's kind of,
yeah,
maybe you can get 3 months, 6 months, and then after that, it's a bit of a, who knows?
No, it was actually handed over in one go. That's why, you know, I was actually managing the cash very tightly. We had more expansion in the US, but I was actually injecting money over to the US at a very sort of controlled, staged exercise, because the exchange rate at that point in time was so poor that we could have lost a lot of money. You know, if you're sending £100,000 over, you know, it was going to be a lot of money to be lost. So that's why most of it was kept in the UK.
And did you use one of the, I'm getting into the reads now, but I'm interested, like, did you use a specialist money transfer, like a third party, or did you just use the bank that you had? Did you worry about the exchange rate?
I used a third party who I've used before, because the exchange rate through the bank was quite bad. The CEO insisted that we actually do a comparator exercise to find out if we transferred the same, you know, $250,000, what would actually end up in the US and what we would be paying. So that's what we did initially, and then sort of carried on making sure that the supply that I was using was actually maintaining the benefit.
The difference would have been, what, a couple of grand, I guess, worth doing, especially for a company that earned.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the first time we looked at it, it was about £4,000 difference. So, yeah.
And would you get a spot trade? Like, would you get quoted each time? Because, I mean, the cliche there is that the FX broker gives you a good deal the first time, and then over time, when you're not paying attention.
I managed to get quite good rates each time. So each time I was quoted, I actually would kindly ask them to go away and sort of think about it again, because we still had X million in the UK which had to be transferred over. So at some point in time that would actually need to go over. I wasn't guaranteeing the business, but they knew that we had to get the money over to the US at some point.
And they bought it, basically. Yeah. So they did. Okay, all right.
I've got a good way about me, James.
Well, that's interesting. It costs nothing to ask, no. Right? And what's your secret when it comes to negotiating that? Do you go hard? Do you put a spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down? Do you have a negotiation strategy?
Just build up a good relationship. I mean, that's the same with any business I do. You know, people buy people. You've got to have that good relationship and actually know what your boundaries are and how far you can go.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm doing negotiation at the moment. You're right. Being open, really open and just friendly, I think does go a long way. No matter how logical we like to think we are, it comes down to when someone's smiling at you, it's hard not to like them and want to help them out. So let me ask you about the controls as well. At that stage, was it the CEO was saying, listen, I need a couple of hundred grand for this or that? Were you making them work to a budget, or what sort of controls did you put in place to trip the money across?
It was just a case of, you know, looking at the cash flow for the next month and making sure that, you know, the money was there. I mean, the key thing at that point in time was that we were growing the team in the US. And of course, the US salaries are a lot higher than in the UK. So it was making sure that everything was over there. Not to mention the fact that, you know, with different states in the US, there's different requirements and regulations and restrictions and laws. So we've got to make sure that whichever state we were looking at, we were actually adhering to that state at that point in time.
And did you use a bureau for managing the different state taxes and so on?
Yes, I got involved with a US outsourced business that specifically deal with the US accounting. So they used their expertise to assist us. Previous financial accountant and I tried to understand the sales tax situation in the US, and it was just beyond us after like about a year. And even the accountants I was talking to in the US who I know said, oh no, I outsource that to my tax specialist. So it was way beyond our ability.
Yeah, it's a whole different setup over there with the state and local taxes. In Canada, it's even more crazy. So it sounds like they had sales even at this stage.
The sales were growing, but, you know, it was a subscription setup. So, you know, people were signing up for a period of time. Yeah, the sales were sort of slow and like small at the beginning, but, you know, it was growing.
Okay, so what happened on the morning of the 10th of March, 2023?
If I recall, it was actually a Friday. I knew nothing about it on the morning. It was sort of after lunch that I got a call from one of the investors saying that, you know, they heard that the bank had actually, there was a run on it and that we needed to do something. And unfortunately, at the time, the CEO was actually at that point living in New York. So he didn't know. So I contacted the CTO in the UK and we just started trying to actually work out what to do next. I've got a wide network of complementary accountants and other sort of tax advisors around me, and sort of trying to work out what we could do, which banks could we actually raise? Could we actually move the money to, you know, just look at the different options available to us, because at that point in time, we still had bulk of the money in one bank account in the UK. And unfortunately, with only £85,000 in any one institution being secure, that would have left us with a huge loss, which the investors would not be happy with.
Yeah, so you mentioned the 85K. That's a state guarantee in the US?
That's in the UK.
Right.
In the US, I think it was $250,000, but we didn't have that much in the US because I was keeping it all in the UK. So, you know, in retrospect, I would have actually rethought my process, but, you know, it all came out in the wash, as I say.
Well, they only had one job, as they say, and who knew that they weren't going to be able to do that job. So did you have an account manager with SVB, or were you just like refreshing? I guess the website was crashing because everyone's trying to log in and see what's going on.
Yeah, we did have an account manager, both in the US and in the UK, but obviously when there was a run, they didn't know if they had jobs, therefore they weren't as responsive to the clients as they had been.
I guess then you were just back to the online portal, and there's a limit, serious limits on how much you can transfer from the online portal.
Basically, nothing would go through. I even tried to get payroll through on the Friday to make sure the staff got paid, and it just wouldn't go through.
Right.
Because that would have been a week early, but I just wanted to make sure that the staff were being paid, but it just didn't go through.
Good way to prioritize it, actually. I suppose you're right. That's the number one thing you got to make sure, is that the money there for the staff.
Yeah.
So you got the call from the anxious investor.
Yeah.
You get on, you try to make a transfer. Nothing happens because it's not working.
No.
What was your next move?
When the CEO got the messages that there was a problem, we had a conference call, and basically we worked all weekend just trying to look at different eventualities, different banks that we might be able to like set up, just to actually try and have a second and third version of what we could do if we could actually get the money out.
Kind of scenario planning, thinking about the options. And I guess the options are pretty limited. If you can't do a transfer, you were looking at maybe having to forego it altogether. That's not ultimately what happened.
It was mentioned, but we didn't actually investigate that because we were just trying to actually recover the situation, basically.
Over the weekend, I mean, no one's taking your call. Was there any back channels you could use or anything to be able to set up these things? Or was it a question of just getting ready for Monday morning?
Some of the other banks were, you know, they were active that weekend and allowing us to sort of set accounts up both in the UK and in the US. We did have Silicon Valley both in the UK and the US, but we were looking at different options in the UK and the US, just actually what was most convenient and what would be most suitable for our needs at that point, if that was the next stage.
And how did it feel to be in the middle of all this? Were you actually fairly calm?
In retrospect, yes, I was calm, you know, because it's a case of, well, if there's a fire, you deal with it, and then you actually think about it after the event. So, I mean, there was no point panicking because there was just nothing to gain. Although I wasn't an employee of the company, I felt part of the team, and I wanted to make sure that, you know, this organization, this business that was being set up for a very good and just cause, was actually not going to be torpedoed in the water because it's something out of their control, basically.
So what was the end of the story there? Some people might remember, but on the Monday then, they opened back up again. Did you manage to get the money out? Did you end up leaving it there? What happened?
The money was actually ring-fenced for, I think, nearly a week, week and a half. What we had to do was we had to sort of get in touch with suppliers and sort of let them know what had happened. I think we told the staff, I can't remember, but I think we told them because that would have been payroll that week. It was just trying on a day-by-day basis to see if there was any other way of getting any cash in. I can't remember what we were doing exactly, but I mean, things like R&D tax credits where you get money from the UK government, if there was any other way that we could get cash in, if we could do that. But I mean, we looked at it, but it wasn't viable at the point.
So at the end of the day, about a week and a half later, HSBC bought SVB. Was that right? Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And then at that stage, you were able to bring your money back into the UK.
What they did was they actually set up an account in the UK and in the US with HSBC. It was like running in parallel for a time. And then at one point through a month, it actually then all sort of like the SVB closed and we were then using HSBC. So I remember quite clearly that I was working with the bookkeeper and sort of making sure that she downloaded all of the statements in SVB every day to make sure we had like the audit trail, because once the SVB was closed, there was no way going back to it, and then we couldn't have reconciled anything. So it was making sure both in pounds and in dollars that we had all of the information in the UK and in the US ledgers to make sure that we could actually run the accounts.
guarding against this sort of situation in the future? Is there anything that can be done, or is this just a risk you have to accept?
It's not a risk to accept, but I think what I would strongly recommend is, you know, especially when you've got investor money, is cash management is one of the prime operations that a CFO needs to do. I mean, I work with, as I say, my extended accounting community, and we've got a service that we use to do cash management, to ring fence the £85,000 in different institutions, so that you are spreading the risk. Yes, you know, 5 million, you'd have to spread it a long way. But at least if we had, you know, it's spread out. If you're going to lose something, it wouldn't be all of it.
So explain to me how that service works. It's a brokerage, or do they give you a unified account, or do you have like whatever 15 or 20 different statements coming at you?
You have like an account that you've got access to and can manage, and then they manage your money in the background in the different institutions.
So they give you a unified report.
Yeah.
You get one bank statement.
Yeah.
Although physically that money is there opening and closing bank accounts in the background.
If you think simplistically at your bank account, you would have a current account and you have a savings account. It's the same sort of thing. It's in the same institution, but it's in different accounts. I mean, I've got to admit that, you know, in the past 2 years, I actually got to the point where my cash flow was quite healthy. So I opened a Starling account. So I had a bricks and mortar and a new version of bank account to spread my money out. Just to be on the safe side.
Based on experience, I guess.
Yeah, it hammers at home, especially when it's your own money.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I can see that, yeah. Okay, cool. So you can use Serati services. What would you call them? Are they, what do they go by? Are they custom banking, or who are these people that manage the different bank accounts for you?
It is a cash management service.
So if you Google that, you'll find a list of them, I guess.
Yeah, or contact me.
Oh, contact, of course, Julia. Nice move, yes. It's worth thinking about. And I'm guessing, when is it worth doing? I mean, there are obviously fees involved in having this service. Is it a fixed fee, or is it a percentage of the income under management?
I think it depends on how much we're talking about.
So once you're over, obviously, 5 million, it's worth considering. I suppose 85K in theory, whatever you can afford to lose is the answer.
Well, I mean, whatever's material for you. I mean, it's the same with gambling. You only gamble how much you can afford to lose. So...
yeah, in theory, if you're doing it right.
Yes.
Okay, you got out of that one alive. It went well.
Yeah.
And that's the recommendation, is to think of a cash management service. It's not something I personally thought about, but actually, yeah, maybe it makes sense when you say it. So I like to ask people when they come on the show about their business heroes, because I'm always interested. So do you have a business hero, Julia?
Nobody actually sprung to mind immediately, but sort of going through sort of way back last century when I did my A-levels and sort of further education, I was, you know, doing business studies, and sort of Richard Branson and Oprah Winfrey came to mind. I mean, the Richard Branson one is, as a non-conventional businessman, he was very successful. And the way he was successful was by surrounding himself with experts who actually had the same vision and same mission. Therefore, there was less friction, I would say, in his organizations, but they were having fun. Having gone through corporate life and having gone through my own sort of business, I have the best time when I'm having fun. So that's good. And Oprah Winfrey, you know, she's had a lot of discrimination sort of thrown at her, but she's been very successful. But her empathy for herself and others is actually testament. You know, she deserves to succeed because of everything she actually, you know, she shares, which is great.
Oprah is a great example of, I mean, we're all kind of used to that sort of hard driving cliche of a business leader who's sort of tough, and but you can, it shows that there's another way. You can do it with love and empathy, and obviously she's super, super successful.
Yeah,
that's why I like heroes, because it shows there's different paths. It doesn't have to be every path. You can sort of, it doesn't have to be exactly what you want to do, but you can take what you like from different people, and it makes you realize there's many different ways to get to where you want to go. Maybe you can reiterate before we wrap up, you know, who is an ideal customer for you as specifically as possible, and how can people get in touch with you?
I constantly reinvent myself. So every 6 months, I've got to rethink who do I want to work with. Currently, what I'm looking for are growing family-oriented businesses, sort of turnover probably between 750,000 up to 10 million, because beyond that, they've got an in-house one of me. They've got their compliance, their bookkeeping, tax returns, year end being done either in-house or externally. But the CEO is lonely at the top and just needs somebody to have a sounding board, a trusted advisor. They're looking for growth, either diversification or relocation. They might just want to look at what the organization they've got themselves, could that be done better? Because with the growth that they've had, you know, the spreadsheets don't work anymore. The way that they've got people doing different jobs doesn't work anymore. And it's just somebody looking at the same thing with a different pair of eyes. So that's where I can come in on a, you know, a part, like on a monthly retainer scenario and help them out, sort of leave them to do what they need to do, but just be there to actually guide them or coach them in helping them be better, get them to delegate, to outsource, to, you know, to stop doing what they're doing badly, but to let somebody else who actually is an expert in it do it so they can grow and go back to what they love.
Great.
And to contact me, I'm on LinkedIn, Julia Leask, and my website is leaskas.co.uk.
Great. Thanks, Julia. And listener, thank you very much for getting this far in the podcast. I really appreciate it. You can sign up for our newsletter at procurementexpress.com/newsletter, where you'll get unique insights into the podcast. We also include tools and tips, industry news, and some tools. We always put in some software tools people can use to help improve the efficiency of their business. I really enjoy interviewing fractional CFOs. As you can see, each one has its own style. If you are one of those fractional CFOs and you're interested in coming on the podcast and chatting about how you do it, I'd love to hear from you. So until the next time, we'll see you in the next one.